Nutrient loading from non-point source runoff is a common problem in watersheds. Nitrogen and phosphorus pollution continue to be included as top causes of aquatic ecosystem degradation across the nation. This webcast will examine the serious impacts on water quality from excess nutrients and will highlight two exceptional programs at the state and local level that encourage homeowners, businesses, and neighborhoods to adopt more sustainable practices to prevent harmful runoff from yards and lawns. Our first speaker will provide a description of the water quality problems associated with nutrients and a description of EPA's national program to set water quality criteria for nutrients, followed by state and community perspectives on nutrient management initiatives as alternatives to conventional lawn care practices. We hope you will get helpful ideas on how your community can encourage more sustainable lawn care practices to protect its water resources. So now, let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Steve Potts, is EPA's acting nitrogen and phosphorus pollution criteria team leader within the Office of Science and Technology here in EPA's Office of Water. Steve has been working with this program since 2001. He's been instrumental in establishing a technical support center which provides states and tribes with a wide variety of services including statistical analysis, scientific peer review, workshops, and webcasts. Steve has a master's degree in environmental science and policy from Johns Hopkins University. Our second speaker, Ondine Wells, is the statewide builder and developer coordinator for the Florida Yards and Neighborhoods Program of the University of Florida. She provides educational resources and training on Florida-friendly landscapes and new construction throughout the state. Previously, Ondine served as the director of a nonprofit environmental education program for at-risk youth here in Washington, D.C., although Ondine will be joining us by phone from Gainesville, Florida. Ondine holds an M.S. in ecology from the University of Florida. Our final speaker of the day, Mona Menezes, is a forester by training and often uses a total ecology approach to stormwater education. Mona helped build a team to successfully launch Show Me Yards and Neighborhoods for a Missouri city of 90,000 people, Columbia. The Show Me Yards program has had roughly 1,000 people participate in watershed-friendly practices since its inception just 3 years ago. She is also responsible for fulfilling the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System's goals for outreach, education, and public involvement for the city. And Mona will be joining us by phone from Columbia, Missouri. So now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Steve, take it away.
Thanks. And thanks for joining us today, and it's my pleasure to talk with you. Today's topics for the webcast, nutrient impacts in your watershed, and that's what I'm going to be talking about. So if you will move to slide 4, today's series of webcasts are geared towards watershed groups, municipalities, and people responsible for communicating to the public about these issues. The intent is for you to leave this webcast with a basic understanding of what nutrient pollution is, how individuals contribute to nutrient pollution, and what we as individuals and members of organized watershed groups can do to reduce it. This first presentation is intended to lay the conceptual groundwork for these discussions, and we'll begin with some introductory materials. They may be repetitive to some members of the audience, but I heard a statistic recently that approximately 96% of Americans don't really know what a watershed is, so that's where I'd like to start. I'll then provide some introductory information on the elements of concern, nitrogen and phosphorus, provide some examples of their sources, and finally I'll discuss how EPA is working to assist states, tribes, and territories deal with these problems as a context for showing how individuals and watershed groups can play an extremely important role as well. In essence, we all have a role to play. If you'll move to slide 5, please. To understand nutrient pollution and how you can help reduce it, you first need to understand watersheds. A watershed is an area of land that drains into a common body of water. Within a watershed, each small body of water will flow into another, larger body of water, creating one interconnected system. You may have heard of the Chesapeake Bay watershed or the Mississippi River watershed. Both are examples of large watersheds within the United States, but watersheds can also be small. There is a watershed for the creek or stream in your neighborhood, and basically, we are always in a watershed. Slide 6, please. When precipitation falls within a watershed, the water eventually enters a water body as stormwater runoff or through groundwater recharge. In this example of a developed area, the rainwater washes over paved surfaces and does not have an opportunity to percolate through the ground. Pollutants are carried in the runoff water into streams, lakes, groundwater, estuaries, and oceans. Dirt, bacteria, nutrients, metals, and pesticides are just a few of the pollutants that make their way into the water bodies through stormwater runoff. The focus of this presentation will be the nutrient pollution. Slide 7. In this example of an undeveloped area, the ground is not paved, so the runoff has an opportunity to flow over surfaces that allow the water to percolate into the soil. Plants and soil act as a natural filter by absorbing some of the water and nutrients, as well as a physical means to slow the water's flow and allow it to saturate and percolate through the ground. Slide 8. Before we talk about the problems that nutrients cause, let's first talk just basically about some of the science behind nutrients. You can see on this slide that both nitrogen and phosphorus are members of group 15 on the periodic table, and that's known as the nitrogens. According to Wikipedia, binary compounds of this group can be referred to collectively as nictides, and the spelling derives from the Greek word nigene, which means to choke or stifle, which is the problem we'll be addressing today. So on slide 9, we'll talk about what are nutrients. There are elements like nitrogen and phosphorus that occur naturally in water, soil, and air. They come from several different sources, for example, decaying plant matter and human and animal wastes. Our ecosystems depend on nutrients to function properly, but too much nitrogen and phosphorus can cause problems. Our common everyday practices introduce larger quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus into the environment than would be naturally introduced. For example, some of the dish and laundry detergents we use every day contain phosphate, a form of phosphorus. The fertilizers we use on our gardens and lawns are also a significant source of the nutrients that enter our waterways. First, we'll talk about nitrogen on slide 10. Nitrogen is very soluble. This property allows it to be absorbed by plants very quickly within weeks of application. However, this property also makes it a threat to water quality because it can be washed out of soils easily by rain or irrigation water. Fertilizers containing nitrogen promote shoot growth. Conversely, fertilizers that do not contain nitrogen promote the growth of flowers, fruits, and roots. So a brief summary of how nitrogen works on slide 11. The element nitrogen combines with other elements to form compounds. Some common nitrogen compounds that you may be familiar with include ammonium, ammonia, nitrite, and nitrate. In fact, 78% of our atmosphere is composed of the inert form of nitrogen. While plants need nitrogen to grow, they can't easily use every form of nitrogen available. For example, plants are not able to directly access nitrogen from the air. Plants are able to use the inorganic forms of nitrogen, nitrate, ammonium, and ammonia. And in the soil, there are microorganisms that convert nitrogen into ammonium and nitrate. Nitrogen moves among its different forms through the nitrogen cycle. And for more information on that, Wikipedia Online has a good description and an EPA-generated representation of the nitrogen cycle. Nitrate is inorganic and is a commonly used form of nitrogen in fertilizers. It's very soluble in water and does not bind to soils. With excessive watering or runoff, nitrate is easily washed away from the plant and enters groundwater or surface water defined as rivers, lakes, and streams. Ammonia, ammonium, nitrate, and nitrite have the greatest impact on water quality because these forms are directly available or are easily converted to a directly available form for plant and algal use. Total nitrogen, which is a summation of all the forms of nitrogen, inorganic and organic, is often used to measure and assess nitrogen levels in water bodies. And next, we'll move to phosphorus on slide 12. In a natural freshwater environment, phosphorus is found in very small quantities. However, in human-impacted aquatic environments, there are often larger quantities of the phosphorus compound phosphate. Increased phosphate levels in aquatic environments are a threat to water quality because phosphate fuels the growth of algae and a phenomenon called eutrophication that we will discuss further in just a moment. A little more on phosphorus on slide 13. Unlike nitrogen, phosphorus does not naturally exist as a gas in the atmosphere. phosphorus can be found naturally in rocks and natural phosphate deposits. Natural processes like weathering and erosion release phosphorus into terrestrial environments. Phosphorus is always found in a compound state, bound with other elements. Phosphorus is found in organic and inorganic forms, and it is through the phosphorus cycle that it moves between these forms. In its organic form, phosphorus is bound to living or dead plant animal tissue and is in the byproduct of a biological process such as animal excretions. Organic phosphorus is not available to plants for use. Phosphorus is most stable in its inorganic form, and it is in this form that it is usable by plants and algae. Inorganic phosphorus occurs as an orthophosphate, often referred to as phosphate, or a polyphosphate. Scientists refer to this form of phosphorus as SRP, or soluble reactive phosphorus. For rivers and streams, SRP is often used to measure the phosphorus level in the waterways because this is the form that encourages algal growth. Total phosphorus levels are commonly used to measure the phosphorus levels of lakes and reservoirs, a total of the inorganic and organic sources of phosphorus. So why do lakes and reservoirs use total phosphorus instead of SRP to measure phosphorus levels? Well, in lakes and reservoirs, phosphorus will remain in that location for a longer period than it would in a flowing stream or river, thus providing an opportunity for the organic forms to move through the phosphorus cycle in a lake or reservoir and eventually be transformed into the inorganic form and utilized by the plants or algae. The way they use this on slide 14, and when it becomes a problem, is in a process called eutrophication. When too many nutrients enter a waterway, they fuel an explosion of phytoplankton, an occurrence that we refer to as an algal bloom. The process itself is called eutrophication, and it results in sometimes thick algal mats blocking sunlight from reaching other underwater plants, which cause the plants to die. Algae themselves have a very short lifespan, and after they and other plants die, they sink to the bottom of the waterway. Bacteria consume oxygen while breaking down the algae, using up the limited resources that are available. As a result of the algal blooms, dissolved oxygen levels drop in the waterway, and aquatic organisms like fish are unable to breathe. In some cases, the algal blooms produce toxins that make water unsafe for human contact. You may not see algal blooms in the stream or lake near your home, but it's important to remember that downstream waters could be impacted as nutrient runoff increases and reaches unhealthy levels. So how big of a problem is this? Well, on slide 15, you can see the nutrients are included in the top five causes of water body impairment. Every 2 years, states are required by the Clean Water Act, Section 303D, to report which water bodies within the state do not meet state-set water quality standards. You can view your own state's most recent list of impaired waters at the website listed at the bottom of your screen. Once you go to this site, click on your state in the interactive map. The next page will provide a synopsis of your state's water body health. Towards the top of this page, each state also has a link to the state-hosted water quality website. I'd like to move now to some very brief examples of what we refer to as non-point source contributions of nutrient impairments on slide 16. I mentioned earlier that nutrients come from a variety of sources such as pet wastes, septic tanks, and fertilizer. We have some data in the following slides from specific regions of the country that show the sources of nutrients in certain watersheds. Although your region may not be represented in this presentation, these examples seem to be representative of what's happening around the country. The first example on slide 17 is the Kinikinik River in Wisconsin. Pictured on the left side of this slide are pie charts depicting the total nitrogen and phosphorus loads in the Kinikinik River watershed, located just south of Milwaukee in Wisconsin. The Kinikinik is one of three primary rivers that flow into the harbor of Milwaukee. Kinikinik is an Ojibwa word, which literally means what is mixed, referring to the mixing of indigenous plants and tobacco. The important thing to note on this slide is that the majority of nutrients entering this watershed come from non-point urban sources. These sources include runoff from land uses such as residential, industrial, and commercial. I like to think of this watershed as a success story in the making. Based on what I've read about local watershed group efforts and an agreement between EPA, the Corps of Engineers, and the state of Wisconsin, this may become an effort that other watershed restoration or rehabilitation efforts will want to study. Next, on slide 18, Sarasota, Florida is south of Tampa and north of Fort Myers on the Gulf of Mexico coast. As with the Wisconsin example on the previous slide, you'll note that in the Sarasota Bay watershed, stormwater runoff is the primary source of nitrogen. For this locality's example, stormwater runoff refers to nitrogen sources including fertilizers, pet wastes, and any other nitrogen sources that would be washed off the ground and into storm drains that lead to local water bodies. Also, as with the previous example, I like to think of this as a success story in the making. You'll hear a presentation next from Florida Yards and Neighborhoods, a group which, among other things, is working in partnership with the Sarasota Bay Estuary Program to educate Floridians about bay-friendly landscaping. And next, on slide 19, I'd like to talk about the Chesapeake Bay. The restoration process for the Chesapeake Bay in the mid-Atlantic portion of the country is one of the older national-scale efforts to restore a watershed. Because of the federal, regional, and local resources that have been appropriated to the Chesapeake Bay, the level of detailed data is greater, and the identified nutrient sources impacting this watershed are more specific than in our Sarasota and Kinnickinnick examples. Two points of particular interest to us on this chart are representing chemical fertilizer. Approximately 73 million pounds, or 26% of the total nitrogen load to the bay in 2005, was due to fertilizer from agricultural and urban suburban areas in the bay watershed. Of this total, approximately 44 million pounds came from agricultural lands and 29 million pounds came from urban suburban lands. A second point is the contribution of atmospheric deposition from vehicles and other mobile sources, electric utilities, and industry. Moving to slide 20. So note here again, urban and suburban sources of phosphorus are a significant portion of the chart. You might be wondering what is meant by the term legacy sediment in stream channels. When this particular watershed was originally settled in the 1700s and 1800s, large swaths of trees were cut down to make room for settlers. This deforestation and later land clearing practices resulted in a significant amount of erosion. Today, sediment resulting from land disturbances in years past is still being flushed through the watershed and it is making its way to the bay. So what does sediment have to do with phosphorus? Moving to slide 21, in addition to being washed directly from lawns and gardens, phosphorus is carried by sediment that is washed into our storm drains and waterways. Earlier in the presentation, we discussed how phosphorus is not very soluble. In fact, it readily binds to soil. When sediment washes off of the land and into our waterways, it carries phosphorus with it. By itself, sediment can smother bottom-dwelling plants and animals such as macroinvertebrates, or which is another name for aquatic insects, oysters, and clams. It can decrease the water's transparency, making the waters cloudy so less light is available for underwater vegetation to grow and produce oxygen. Sediment then carrying nutrients presents an even greater problem. Moving to slide 22, an estimated 18% of sediment loads entering the bay comes from urban and suburban areas. Sediment erosion occurs in an urban-suburban setting when soil is exposed during a precipitation event or during times of high wind. Sediment is washed or blown down storm drains or directly into a nearby waterway. Common areas where this occurs include construction sites, eroded non-tidal stream banks, and spots in lawns and landscapes that are not vegetated. It's important to remember that erosion is a natural process, hence the portion of the pie chart that represents natural forest sources. But when erosion takes place at an accelerated pace and from unnatural causes, which represent 80% of this chart, there is a negative impact on water quality. So in summary, on slide 23, this is a summary path of nutrients. The choices we make on land have a direct impact on water quality. When water runs off our property, nitrogen and phosphorus are carried away by the water. Algal growth is fueled by the addition of nitrogen and phosphorus. The waterway's health declines, and the waterway becomes impaired. So what can we do to stop this process from continuing? On slide 24, I want to move to the federal level and discuss a little bit about the Clean Water Act and how it actually has provisions allowing individuals and watershed groups to participate. The goal of the Clean Water Act is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. In order to help achieve this goal, EPA works with all 50 states and U.S. territories to set and enforce water quality standards for each water body. Each quality standards, or these water quality standards, designate the uses for each water body, meaning the human or ecological activities that take place in the water body, and assign water quality criteria, the levels of nutrients, chemicals, temperature, sediment, or other pollutants that support those uses. Congress recognized that the public has a vested interest in the quality of our nation's surface waters. Therefore, the Clean Water Act requires states and authorized tribes to hold public hearings on their water quality standards at least once every 3 years. Citizens may make recommendations to public officials for improvements or modifications in the standards during the public hearing process. On slide 25, water quality standards are the foundation upon which EPA, state, tribal, and local actions to reduce nutrient concentrations in water bodies are based. Water quality standards set the goal, or criteria, that are considered protective for nutrient concentrations so that appropriate nutrient management actions can be taken and their effectiveness measured. EPA offers an entire week-long course on water quality standards, some of which will be available as online modules similar to the Watershed Academy, and there's also an entire water quality standards handbook available online for more information. So I'm not going to go into much detail here. The main point I want to communicate is that EPA is working with states, tribes, and territories to develop water quality standards for nutrients across the country. These standards will be based on a scientific understanding of the responses of biological communities to both natural and human sources of nutrients and how these interactions affect the designated uses of the water body. Looking at the slide on, or the picture on slide 26, you can see the understanding the relationships between nutrient concentrations, biological communities, and designated uses is not what you would call straightforward. There are a lot of complex interactions which this slide attempts to convey. The fundamental ideas of this slide are that the effects of nutrients on plant, algal, and microbial growth are influenced by factors such as light, flow, temperature, substrate, water chemistry, etc. Plant, algal, and microbial growth influence the conditions such as dissolved oxygen, pH, habitat, aquatic food chain structure, and changes in pathogen communities. These conditions then affect what the Clean Water Act calls a water body's designated uses. And examples included here are aquatic life, recreation, and drinking water. These are just to name a few. The Water Quality Standard is a document which states, tribes, and territories adopt through their legislatures or their adoptive process, and which is based on an evaluation of all this information. Slide 27. So as you can imagine, that's not an easy task, and EPA is working in the following areas to assist states and tribes and territories with these efforts. We have a technical support center, which you can view on our nutrient criteria website called NSTEPS, which provides access to national experts in nutrient science and statistics to help states, tribes, and territories quantify the relationships you just saw and develop numeric nutrient criteria. We've published technical and scientific manuals to guide the development of estuarine and wetland criteria and are working on strategies such as case studies to show how that science can be implemented. We are beginning to develop outreach materials to reach a wider audience about the impacts of nutrients, such as this webcast, and we will be publishing a progress report in May or June describing national efforts to develop numeric nutrient criteria and water quality standards. On slide 28, there are a number of things that individuals and watershed groups can do to reduce nutrient pollution. This list is definitely not exhaustive, but many of the actions on this list will be described by our other speakers, so I will briefly touch on only the first two. And these, by the way, are not in any order of priority. So slide 29, it should actually read, get involved in your state's water quality. And there are many different ways that you can become involved with water quality in your community. You can participate in cleanup activities in your neighborhood, write or call your elected representatives to inform them about your concerns and encourage legislation to protect water resources. Get involved in local planning and zoning decisions and encourage your local officials to develop erosion and sediment control ordinances. And help educate people in your community about ways in which they can help protect water quality. Joining or forming a watershed group is a great way to do this. An EPA's Office of Water webpage, the OWOW webpage, described at the beginning of this webcast, has a lot of information to help you with that, along with presentations on the Watershed Academy. Slide 30 talks more about getting involved in your state's water quality standards. You can visit the website on your slide to learn about your state's water quality standards and where the next opportunity will be to participate in the public review process. When viewing this slide, we recommend visiting the following sections: basic information, which provides background information on water quality standards and their purpose in water quality protection; where you live, which provides links to EPA regional pages pertaining to water quality standards; state, tribal, and territorial standards, which provides links to water quality standard documents for each of the states, tribes, and territories. Finally, I wanted to touch briefly on the second point in the list, which is stream restoration, or rehabilitation as some call it. There is currently emerging a body of science dedicated to understanding the potential stream restoration efforts to reduce nutrient transport to downstream waters, such as some of the estuaries we discussed. Essentially, a natural stream can cycle or handle nutrients better than a stream that has been degraded by loss of habitat and loss of natural channel structure. Last week, in the March 13th Journal of Nature, there was a letter published and an article about the role of stream denitrification. The letter, based on work by Patrick Mulholland and a number of other contributors, states, "Our data suggest that the total uptake of nitrate is related to ecosystem photosynthesis and that denitrification is related to ecosystem respiration." Although the letter does not mention stream restoration, I would argue that stream restoration efforts could help to bring stream photosynthesis and restoration rates closer to their natural, unimpacted conditions than those that would have a greater ability to limit the amount of nitrate available for algal growth and for transport to larger rivers and estuaries. So if you would like additional information on restoration or any of the other topics I've presented here, please feel free to contact me either by phone at 202-566-1121 or by email to pots.steve@epa.gov. Thank you, and I believe we'll now answer some questions.
Thank you very much, Steve. Yes, we will pause briefly here on slide 31 to take some questions. Let's begin with those submitted online. And just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Carl from Edgemont, Pennsylvania. And Carl was wondering, since he's a resident of Northeast U.S., how much nitrogen he can expect from atmospheric deposition, and can he adjust his fertilizer application to allow for the amount of atmospheric deposition?
That is a great question. I don't have any data here in front of me that I could use to answer that, but I think that's something that we can take a look and see if the atmospheric deposition in any region of the country has been quantified. So I would say, Carl, if you want to give me a call or send me an email, that's something that I'll have to do some investigating to look into, but I would be glad to see what I can find out to help you there.
Okay, and I would add, this is Don Way, and I would add that I have heard Tom Schuler from the Center for Watershed Protection talk about what a great gift we have that we get so many pounds of free nitrogen from the sky every year. So certainly the sentiment that some reduction in your application rates has been at least proposed. We have another question, and this is from Steve in Marina, California. Steve writes, "I live and work in a coastal area. Urea has been indicated as a likely trigger for toxic algal blooms. From what I understand, there are three possible sources of urea: ag fertilizers, home fertilizers, and sanitary sewage. Is there any information or research parsing out the various contributions? Dischargers are pointing the finger at each other."
another interesting question, which again, I don't have any data here with me that I could begin to address that with. In fact, I don't know if that particular question has been addressed, but Steve, I will be glad to take a look and see what I can find out. And if you will either call me or email me with your contact information, I'll let you know what I find. Thanks.
This is Don Way again, and the fallback answer that when I get questions like that is when it comes to non-point source and mixture with point sources as well, we sort of use the old POGO expression, which is we have met the enemy and he is us. Okay. At this time, we will move on to our next session. Take it away, Ondine. Ondine, are you there? Okay. Ondine, if you are there, please go ahead and do your trick to unmute yourself. Okay. Let's go ahead and take some questions. Let's go ahead and take some questions from our audience. So if you could go ahead and unmute yourself if you have a question. If you don't have a question and there's music playing in the background, everyone can hear it. So please go ahead and mute yourself unless you have a question. And at this point, the floor is now open for questions.
Is it on Dean that's playing music?
Okay, at this point, we are going to skip this question. We are having some technical difficulties. People are playing some background music. And we may not have Ondine available through due to some difficulty communicating with our second speaker of the day. So we will jump to slide 61 at this point and hear from Mona Menezes in Columbia, Missouri.
Okay. Don, I'm yes? sorry, I finally got the phone to work.
Ondine, is this you?
Yes, it is. I really apologize to everybody. For some reason, my phone was having some issues getting it unmuted. So I am here, and I apologize for the delay.
Super, Ondine.
Okay, hopefully everybody can hear me this time. I'd like to start off the presentation on slide 33. I'm going to be discussing first an introduction to some of the challenges that we're facing here in Florida. I'll then go over our Florida Yards and Neighborhoods program and discuss some of the educational resources that our program is providing statewide. And then I'll sum up with a number of case studies working with developments as well as counties and cities. So you can move to slide 34. Some of you might know Florida is one of the fastest growing states in the country, and as our population has continued to increase, so is our impact on the natural environment. And with each new home that has been built or each new development, there's obviously also an increasing demand and stress on our water resources. The graph to the right just shows an indication of the increasing freshwater withdrawals that we're seeing statewide. And this is indicative of all of the counties throughout the state. If you could move to slide 35. Surprisingly, where homes are having some of the greatest impacts on water is actually in their home landscape. Studies have shown that between 25 to 60% of homeowner water use is actually coming from going towards the landscape for irrigation purposes. Some studies have shown actually an excess of 60% of homeowner water use. So there's a real drain on our water systems for irrigation. We also know, as Steve eloquently pointed out, that nutrient runoff can cause increasing degradation in our water bodies. The lower right photograph shows a dramatic example of an algal bloom here in the St. Johns River in northeast Florida that occurred just a couple of years ago. And these algal blooms not only have dramatic environmental impacts, but they can also have huge impacts on the local economy. So we definitely want to try to find ways to avoid these in the future. We move to slide 36.
Ondine?
Yes.
Right in here.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I need to ask you to speak up a little bit.
I'm sorry?
I need you to ask. I need to ask you to speak up a little bit.
Okay. For some reason, I'm okay. Can you hear me a little bit better?
I can.
Okay. Hopefully, everyone else can too. So, how do we address these issues and these impacts on the landscape? The Florida Yards and Neighborhoods Program is a University of Florida extension program, and our goal is to really teach Florida-friendly landscaping principles. We partner with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, regional water management districts, as well as local programs such as the estuary program that Steve mentioned. Slide 37. Our Florida-friendly landscaping goals are really threefold. We seek to reduce water consumption. We want to protect our water quality, but we also want to design landscapes that are appealing to people, but also appealing to our wildlife habitat. Slide 38. The Florida Yards and Neighborhoods program began as a residential education program in the 1990s. We've expanded that program statewide. Of the 67 counties in Florida, FYN is currently operating in 45 counties. And if you look at the map, the counties in orange are those counties where we still provide, where we only provide homeowner education. The counties that are highlighted in green have expanded to include a wider range of audiences, including builders, developers, landscape maintenance professionals, irrigation contractors, and in some cases even real estate professionals. Each county operates their FYN program in the county extension office, and so their offering of resources may vary depending on the specific county's needs. Moving on to slide 39, Florida-friendly landscaping is based on an integrated approach to landscape design and maintenance. It's based on 9 principles, and I'll briefly go through each of those 9 principles to give you an idea of how we address the landscape. The first principle is right plant, right place, and essentially this is the key to selecting plants that are based on your specific site criteria. And at first this sounds pretty logical, but it actually can be a little tricky. Even within a specific home lot, you might find that your site criteria vary quite a bit around the individual lot. So it's really important to look at all of the criteria throughout the entire lot to select those plants that are appropriate. The second principle is focused on watering efficiently. So this looks at water reuse, and also reducing the amount of water that's going towards irrigation. The third principle, fertilize appropriately, is really looking at how we can lower the amount of fertilizer we are putting onto the landscape. Our program advocates for using the lowest amount from our extension recommendations. And those will vary depending on what part of the state you are in. The fourth principle is looking at mulch. Obviously, we want to reduce erosion and also retain moisture in the landscape to reduce those watering needs. The fifth principle is to attract wildlife. Some of you may not realize this, but Florida is actually the fourth in the nation for the number of species that we have. And of those, 650 species are endemic, which means that found nowhere else on the earth. So that's pretty exciting for us as a state. But on the other hand, we have 70 endangered species, which places us second in the nation. So really trying to increase the biodiversity in our home landscapes in terms of plant material, as well as attracting and supporting wildlife, is really important. Moving on to slide 40. The 6 principles to manage yard pests responsibly. Only 1% of insects actually pose a problem to plants, and so we really advocate for integrated pest management techniques, also known as IPM, and this is to support those beneficial insects, which can actually feed on your problem pests, and to only spot treat when absolutely necessary. Our seventh principle to reduce stormwater runoff is to try to retain stormwater as much in the lot as possible. And I'll discuss some of this a little bit more in detail. Our eighth principle is to recycle. This is to use recycled materials in your landscape, but also to reuse your landscape debris as a compost material. And the last, but certainly not the least important, is to protect our valuable waterfront. And we advocate for a minimum of a 10-foot fertilizer and pesticide-free zone around waterways, and also to plant a vegetative buffer to help provide increased habitat, but as well as to absorb extra nutrients that may be flowing or running off into those waterways. Moving on to slide 41. One of the ways that we are advocating for reducing stormwater runoff is in the creation and inclusion of low-impact development design techniques. And for those of you that aren't familiar with the low-impact development term, it basically means that we are trying to increase the amount of infiltration of rainwater into the soil by actually decreasing the amount of impervious surface. And Steve touched on this a bit in terms of how we want to decrease the amount of runoff. So here we have two examples of swales here in Florida. On the left side, we have a condominium association that has removed their raised curb and gutter and allows for flow of that rainfall on the road into a more depressed vegetative area. And on the right, we have a very high traffic parking lot actually here at the University of Florida. And it may be difficult to see, but if you look at the front of those vehicles, you'll notice some curb cuts. And that allows the water from the parking lot to flow into that vegetative swale to collect rainwater. So we are advocating these throughout the state. And on slide 42, you'll see another technique of low-impact development. This is looking at porous asphalt. There are a lot of pervious surfaces that are being studied and advocated for. In this case, you can see an example of how porous asphalt absorbs the rainwater as compared to standard asphalt, where the rainwater tends to stay on the surface. And all of these techniques are ones that we are working with developers to incorporate in their new development. Slide 43. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the resources that our program provides to each of our stakeholder groups. For our homeowners, we have an extensive handbook, as you'll see here. It's a guide to Florida-friendly landscaping. This is provided both in print and on web, and it provides extensive information to the homeowner as to how to implement each of the 9 principles. Extension agents within each county often also provide consultations, educational workshops, in some cases, home recognition programs with yard signs, and a soil analysis, which you can often get through the extension office to define what your soil type is. Slide 44 describes our new website that we worked with in conjunction with the Department of Environmental Protection here in Florida, floridayards.org. And one of the great resources on this website in the bottom left-hand corner is the Florida Friendly Plant Database. And this database includes a long list of Florida Friendly plants that you can search for and develop your own personalized plant list based on your existing site conditions. So it's a wonderful resource not only for homeowners, but also it's being utilized by landscape designers. In slide 45, we have some of the resources that are available for green industry professionals. The Green Industries BMP training program was developed by a committee of stakeholders and partly funded through the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. And this program provides training statewide to professionals on proper design and installation of landscaping materials, irrigation, fertilization, maintenance procedures, and pest control. There is a list of trained professionals available online to homeowners looking to hire trained professionals. And this program has really gained momentum statewide and is being advocated by a number of county government firms. We also have a landscape architect CEU training, a continuing education course, and this training provides information on low-impact development, irrigation, habitat, managing habitat for wildlife, and landscape design. Slide 46. Some of the resources that we have for developers and engineers, these are growing as the demand has increased. We provide landscaping and irrigation design plan review. So developers or landscape architects that have landscape designs, irrigation designs, we will review those and ensure that the design is made to Florida-friendly standards. We have an annual awards program to recognize those developments that are achieving a high standard of Florida-friendly landscaping. And our own program, Florida Yards and Neighborhoods, has a certification program for new construction. We've also, however, collaborated and our principals have been integrated into a number of other certification programs, such as Florida Water Star and the Florida Green Building Coalition, which are both working to do statewide work on water conservation and green building, respectively. On slide 47, some additional resources that we provide for developers. We have collaborated with the University of Florida's Program for Resource Efficient Communities. This is another extension program here. They have developed a low-impact development continuing education training, and we collaborate on some of the content for that program, and that has gained, again, a lot of interest among developers. We also have a model covenants, conditions, and restrictions language. This was developed by the University of Florida College of Law, and it provides language that developers may incorporate into their community restrictions. And it includes language that defines what is a Florida-friendly landscape and how those landscapes should be ideally maintained in the long run. Slide 48. We also have some resources for local governments. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection developed a model Florida-friendly ordinance. This is available online for counties who would like to implement an ordinance in their county. And on our website, which you can see here, we do have links to city and county ordinances throughout the state. So we can reference, we can keep track of these and reference them for people who are looking to develop or learn about ordinances. Some of the ordinances may be specific to irrigation. Some of them may be specific to landscaping. Others may be more green building oriented. So there's a variety of different approaches out there. On slide 49, we also are working with the Program for Resource Efficient Communities on a low-impact development training that is not a CU program, but specifically developed for government employees, specifically planners, architects, and as well as private architects. And this provides general overview on low-impact development and what how these can be incorporated into new developments. Lastly, there is a relatively new standard finalized last December, the Florida Irrigation and Florida-Friendly Design Standards. This was developed by a statewide committee on landscape irrigation and Florida-friendly design, a statewide committee, and basically it does advocate for Florida-friendly principles to be implemented. So it's a great reference tool for us to be utilizing statewide. On slide 50, I'd like to touch briefly on some of the ongoing research that's here at the University of Florida. Our program is science-based, and so our recommendations are based on current scientific research. So we are really excited by some of the work that's going on here by scientists. Dr. Michael Dukes is doing some research on irrigation efficiency. Specifically, he's looking at new technologies such as soil moisture sensors and evapotranspiration controllers. The photo to the top right shows what a soil moisture sensor can look like if you're not familiar with one. It's a sensor that's placed in the root zone, in this case of turf, and it's usually placed in the area of the landscape that has the highest water requirements. And what it will do is measure the moisture of that soil and then base it on the needs of the plant and tell the irrigation system if it needs to be watered or not. So these are excellent tools for increasing water irrigation efficiency, and Dr. Dukes is finding some really interesting data on this. We also have scientists working on the water needs for plants, for establishment of plants. So how much do we really need to water plants once they've been put into the ground to actually establish them and then taper off their water? We have research going on turf grass and watering and nutrient needs, and also there's research going on nutrient leaching on turf grass. And we have a new site that's been developing in the last couple of years. It's called the Florida Partnership for Water, Agriculture, and Community Sustainability at Hastings in St. Johns County, which is in northeast Florida. And this site is going to have some specific research focused on low-impact development. And we will have some demonstration areas for Florida-friendly landscaping. So we are very excited about this and are looking forward to some of the research outcomes of this site. Slide 51, I will briefly touch on now a couple of case studies to show how these principles are being implemented. The first case study I'll discuss is the Madeira community. This is in Gainesville, Florida, here in north central Florida. It's a relatively small development of 44 acres and 88 homes. This development was built on a wooded lot, so they had a lot of great natural assets to begin with. But they really took advantage of that by designing the community such that there were going to be narrow roads. The roads would be uncurbed, so they would receive runoff into the vegetated areas. And there was really limited clearing done for each of the home lots, so this really helped to provide, retain the natural vegetation and increase the amount of pervious surface within the community. Slide 52. This is the landscape design for the model home in Madeira. This landscape design incorporated a number of innovative techniques. They had a rain garden, very small turf areas. It included a shared driveway with the adjacent lot to reduce the amount of impervious surface. There was also an infiltration tank that received water from the roof. This was designed to be a zero-discharge lot, so the intention was for all of the rainwater that fell onto the lot to be retained on the lot. Slide 53, we will look at a couple of these techniques up close. In the photographs, you can see the shared driveway, which is actually using pervious pavers. And you can see on the landscape that the amount of turf that was used was reduced, and because it had been reduced and it was combined with a very efficient irrigation system, they were actually able to achieve a 50% savings on irrigation as compared to conventional lots. Slide 54 shows an up-close picture of the exfiltration tank that was installed, that this gentleman standing on in the top left. These tanks receive roof runoff and allow the water to then infiltrate into the soil. This tank is strong enough that when covered with reinforced turf, it can actually be used as an extra parking space. The irrigation system also included a soil moisture sensor, which I mentioned before with Dr. Dukes' research. And it's been found that when these are properly installed, they can achieve a savings of up to 50% in irrigation usage. So, again, an excellent technology when utilized correctly. Slide 55. For those of you who might wonder if the Florida-friendly landscaping is going to be too costly, here's a great example of how we can incorporate Florida-friendly landscaping in an affordable way. The Madeira case study incorporated a number of very unique ideas, such as the exfiltration tanks, but that may have actually exceeded a cost that a normal developer would undertake. But in this case, this development is called the Hancock Place. It's a development of 36 homes. All are affordable single-family homes. And the developer really took to heart the idea of making his development as low impact as possible. He's incorporated Florida-friendly landscaping into all of the home lots. He has installed swales as opposed to curb and gutter. He is enhancing his stormwater pond so that it will have increased biodiversity of vegetation to make it more of a wildlife habitat. And he's also incorporated Florida-friendly language into his development CC&Rs. And as a part of that, he is requiring all new homeowners to participate in an educational workshop so that they can learn about what Florida-friendly landscaping is and how they'll actually maintain it as homeowners. All of the lots use only micro-irrigation, and all of the homes are, in addition to having Florida-friendly landscaping, they're also Energy Star and Florida Water Star compliant. And the landscaping cost for these homes was about $1,400 per lot, which if you're knowledgeable of how much is being spent typically on a landscape for a new house, this is pretty reasonable. So this is a very exciting project, and we are seeing more of these throughout the state. On slide 56, I just wanted to touch a little bit on how Florida-friendly principles are being integrated into city and county ordinances. To the right, you have an example here from Sarasota County. Again, this is was touched on by Steve Potts that Sarasota County is doing a lot of innovative things. In this case, they do have a landscaping ordinance. Here you see their checklist. This checklist was included in the ordinance, and it's an outstanding learning tool as well as an accountability tool for builders and developers and landscapers, and was really pivotal in helping to get new developments to comply with this ordinance when it was put into place. Some cities and counties are actually also putting in very creative incentives that touch on some of these issues. The city of DeLand, which is in Volusia County in eastern Florida, provides a 15% rebate on water and sewer impact fees for each residential unit that meets Florida Water Star requirements. And as I mentioned before, Florida Water Star requirements do entail very efficient irrigation systems and Florida-friendly landscaping. Another example is the City of Gainesville's Green Building Ordinance. And this ordinance includes fast-track building permitting and a 50% reduced permitting fee for the builder. So these are some excellent opportunities for builders and developers to start incorporating some of these ideas into their new construction. Slide 57. I wanted to touch a little bit on how we measure success. We have a very successful program statewide, but we are working to increase that measure of our success in a quantifiable way. And one of the ways that we're doing that is we are working with Dr. Michael Dukes here on how to measure our irrigation efficiency. So here we have a model that has been developed. If you look at Community A, you'll see that the light line on the bottom shows what we are going to call the theoretical water needs of the landscape. So this line was determined through weather, rain, temperature, evapotranspiration data, and based on the type of landscape in that community. This is the theoretical need for irrigation water to be applied to that landscape in based on those conditions. If you look at the darker line, that shows the amount of water that was actually used by the community. So in this case, you can see that this community is applying much more water to their landscape than they would ideally need to sustain an aesthetically appealing landscape. So if you compare that to Community B, you can see that the lines are much closer together, indicating that this community happens to be much more water efficient in terms of their irrigation, and much more closer to what the landscape actually needs. So we would like to expand this model and try to use this statewide as a way to interpret what areas of the state are needing more attention in terms of making their systems, their irrigation systems, more efficient. Slide 58. We do have some challenges, as with any program. We do want to create more measurable results for our program. How can we quantify, for instance, our water quality impact of having Florida-friendly landscapes? There are some gaps in the research. We often have more questions than we do answers. There's a need for continued homeowner education. Because our state is growing, a lot of people move to Florida from other climates and are used to a different kind of aesthetic in their landscape. And so educating them about what is natural to the Florida landscape is sometimes a challenge, and it's an ongoing challenge. We also have an interesting dilemma with covenants, community covenants that were in place prior to 2001. Any covenants that were created after October of 2001 are not allowed to prohibit any Florida-friendly landscaping principles. However, if the covenants were in place prior to 2001, they may restrict or demand a homeowner have a landscape that is not Florida-friendly. So this is a challenge that we have been facing with homeowner associations periodically around the state. There is a challenge of getting a developer's buy-in, particularly with the bottom line. And as the housing downturn has impacted developers' bottom line, the Florida-friendly landscaping can be a plus in terms of marketing their communities. But it is a challenge to educate them as to what exactly this means to their own bottom line and to the homeowner, to sell it to the homeowner. And lastly, there currently aren't incentives for developers to incorporate low-impact development into their communities. And we are looking forward to having a new statewide stormwater rule put into place, which Florida Department of Environmental Protection is developing now, and we're hoping that this new stormwater rule will provide actually some incentives for LID and encourage developers to put these in place of some of the more conventional stormwater techniques that they are now using. Slide 59, I just wanted to acknowledge those individuals whose content was used in this presentation. Thank you very much. And if you would like any more information on Florida Yards Neighborhood, you may contact me at 352-392-1831, extension 243, or email me at owells, that's O-W-E-L-L-S, at UFL, that's UF as in Frank, L, dot E-D-U. So I think we'll be moving to questions now.
Thank you very much, Andine. That was wonderful.
We'll pause here. Thank you, Andine. We'll pause here to take some questions. So stay on the line, Andine. And right now, let's begin with those submitted online. And as we have time, we'll open it up to some phone questions as well. Again, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. The first question is from Mary from Fort Myers, Florida, and she asks, as a Florida resident, Florida Yards and Neighborhoods for Homeowners is a great program. How can I get Lee County, Florida, to implement a builder-developer program?
That's a great question, Mary, and there are two things we could do to follow up on that. The first is you and I can talk a little bit about how we initiate the builder-developer program. Also, you have an excellent local extension agent, Tom Becker, who works with Florida Yards and Neighborhoods, and he is actively trying to reach out to the builder-developer community. And so I would love to put you in touch with him. You can feel free to email or call me, and I can tell you a little bit more about some of the local things that he's working on in Lee County.
Okay, thanks. Another question comes from Robin from Salinas, California. And she wants to know, sort of as a follow-up to some of the stuff you mentioned, Do the various covenants and standards have enforcement provisions?
I'm assuming she means enforcement by the HOA, but I'm not sure. As many of you are probably familiar with, HOAs sometimes are very good at enforcement, and then sometimes over time they will sort of wane in their involvement in enforcement. So the CC&Rs are only as good as the homeowner association is going to be in terms of involvement. There are some interesting, potentially interesting legal issues that are being faced with respect to these restrictions and Florida-friendly landscaping. And we're actually working in conjunction with the University of Florida College of Law regularly to try to answer some of these questions and see how the legal landscape, so to speak, will be changing over time. So I don't know if you want some more information on that. Again, feel free to contact me, and I will talk to you a little bit more in detail.
Okay, Andine. Thank you. HOA is Homeowners Association. Next question is from Robert in Waterbury, Vermont. And Robert wants to know, in Florida, is the concept of low-impact development compulsory or voluntary? That is, are new developments required to meet low-impact development standards?
Actually, that's a great question. Currently, it is not required, and that's actually where we have hit some of our challenges. We have developers who are very interested in low-impact development, but have found that they are not getting any credit for the work that they're putting into low-impact development. And so what I mean by credit is they are required to put in a certain size stormwater basin, but if they put in smaller basins, say rain gardens or swales, those will not give them credit towards the stormwater retention that they need to achieve. Therefore, they cannot reduce the size of their stormwater basin if they're incorporating LID. And so that's a big challenge for them, to put in extra money to incorporate LID when they're not then gaining anything in terms of potentially developable space or reduced stormwater basins. And that's where we're really looking forward towards this stormwater rule that should be going through in the next year or so, that will provide incentives and credit in terms of not monetary credit, but credit towards low-impact development design, and will then encourage developers and provide a reason for them to incorporate LID more often.
Okay, Andine. Actually, there's a question that has been posed by Jean from Camden, New Jersey, that is more of a general question, and that I will answer, and then I'll ask another one that pertains to something that you made reference to. And Jean writes that she's interested in the benefits of rain gardens, and can she be directed to some references on rain gardens? And I would say, with regard to online resources, Wikipedia has a good description and a set of links that go to a number of different places. EPA also has a website that goes over various low-impact development practices, including rain gardens, and that's epa.gov/NPS as in non-point source, /LID as in low-impact development. And the next question is from Greg from Columbus, Ohio, and he wants to know what an exfiltration tank is and if it's used for irrigation.
The exfiltration tank that was referenced in this was what they call the tank at the Madeira community. Basically, it receives runoff and only retains water into the tank for a short period of time. That water then filters into the surrounding soil. And I think, what was the other part of the question? I'm sorry.
They wanted to know if it was used for irrigation.
No, this is not actually used for irrigation because it does filter back into the soil. But there are lots of examples, a cistern, for instance, that is being advocated more throughout the state and was actually used quite a bit many years ago in Florida to collect rainwater, and then that water is reused for irrigation. So it's a little bit different.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. And at this time...
Thank you. And at this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question.
Region 3. Oh.
Hello?
Yes, on slide 35, you mentioned that up to 60% of water is used for lawn and landscaping for the homeowners. And I'm assuming that this is probably drinking water with the expensive treatments that go along with it.
In many cases, that is true. There are an increasing number of developments that are using reclaimed water. Thank you. And can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry. The reclaimed water systems actually provide a whole other set of interesting challenges and solutions. Reclaimed water is partially treated and can be then reused on the landscape. And in some cases, there's...
You need to unmute yourself, Andine.
Can everybody hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. The 60% that you were referring to, yes, that is often considered potable water. However, some developments are now using reclaimed water systems, so irrigation is pulling only from reclaimed water sources. In some counties, the reclaimed water is in very short supply and high demand, and in other counties, it's in very high supply and short demand. So it really varies based on the local area as to whether reclaimed water is working well. But the numbers that I referenced, that is looking typically at potable water, which is fully treated water.
Okay, thank you, Andine. At this point, because there's some difficulties with hearing some of the answers to the questions, we're going to go ahead.
Sorry.
No, it's Andine, you were fine. We're going to go ahead and jump right over to slide 61. And before we move on to the final session of today's presentation, slide 61 is an ad for next month's Watershed Academy. Our next website will be, which will be on April 10th. This webcast will cover monitoring watershed program effectiveness. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts, all one word. And I will say that slide needs to have a slight correction to it. Webcasts is plural, and it's all one word, for more information. And we understand that registration is now open. So it is first come, first serve. And now please move to slide number 62, where we will hear from our final section of the presentation. Mona, take it away.
Hi, and welcome to Show Me Yards. Can you hear me okay? Don?
Yes, we can hear you great.
Great. Missouri is known as the Show Me State, and the idea for Show Me Yards was actually modeled after Florida yards and neighborhoods. Plus, Carolina Yards and Neighborhoods has a great program as well. And Show Me Yards was actually brought here by Springfield, Missouri, which is the third largest city in Missouri. It's also known as the Queen City of the Ozarks. And it has a population of about 200,000. I am located in Columbia, Missouri, which is a city of about 90,000. We are right in the center of the state, midway between Kansas City and St. Louis. And I'd like you to note the quote that's down there in the bottom right-hand corner, when one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world. This was, of course, a quote from the famous naturalist John Muir, but this is also the poetic version of what your first speaker, Mr. Potts, called eco-complexities. That's kind of it in a verse form. And the reason I have it in my presentation, all the presentations I do, is because it's quoted by our own city manager. So this goes to show you how things are changing. If we could go to slide 63, please. When we first began to consider building a Show Me Yards program here in Columbia, we just started with the fundamentals first. First of all, with why would we do this at all? because my job as a stormwater educator is in the Public Works Department, and our responsibilities and our mission is very well defined. So branching out into homeowner lawn care needed to be really well thought through. There are lots of private lawn care companies who've been doing business here for 30 or 40 years. They are a legitimate business. They employ a lot of people. They're members of the Chamber of Commerce. So it's very important that we do not demonize the lawn care industry. That being said, the city is very much in the business of water quality, and Show Me Yards provided a great way for us to show citizens the link between their interests, their home and lawn, and water quality. Here in Columbia, we do have an impaired waterway that flows right through the middle of our city, so this helps people understand their possible contribution to that impairment. If we go to slide 64, oh wait, back up just a minute. So the city does have, we're still on 63, the city does have responsibilities for stormwater education, and we do have that impaired stream, which is called Hinkson Creek. Now if we could go to slide 64. So when we first started considering how to start something like Florida Yards and Neighborhoods, of course we looked at Springfield first because they had already started something. They, however, had focused on lawn care providers, and we wanted to focus on homeowners. So we just started with the premise there's absolutely no need to reinvent the wheel when there are already lots of good programs out there. And although Extension often initiates or runs programs like this, there wasn't anything available on a statewide basis here in Missouri. So we just got some great advice and great training from Springfield. Then we came back and called about 10 people that we thought might help us launch something similar. And so basically we started from scratch, if we could go to 65, and ask ourselves who would be willing to help with this. This would seem like a really simple thing, but a program like this is very time-consuming. I estimate that it took me about 25% of my time in the first year and maybe 20% of my time the second year. So you have to be clear who's going to assume the leadership, which basically amounts to the heavy lifting or what it takes to get it done. Now, 3 years later, this runs very smoothly, and everyone listed there on that list takes a chunk of the work, and we rotate our responsibilities. But to get started, someone has to say, I'll take the lead. So all of these people were involved from the very first. Next slide, please. Go to 66. And we threw out all contingencies for discussion. Everything was open. We shaped each one of these questions, and we came to a consensus on them. It was not simple. There was some issues that we were able to work out. We had a lot of discussion on it. But we did decide for a unified concept with Springfield. Even though their whole focus was on lawn care providers, and we decided to go with homeowner outreach and education, we wanted to help build a customer base for lawn care providers so that there would be some demand for watershed-friendly lawn care. So we went with the same name as another city, but there is a city about 30 miles from Columbia that followed our example, but they changed their name to something else, and they charge fees to attend. So there are lots of ways to get this done, but we started out from the very beginning. Next slide, please. We're on 67. These next two slides show some of the results of our team's early decisions. To me, it's very critical to define your scope and your mission. Why were we even doing this? We consider here in the city, we consider Show Me Yards a way to meet our stormwater permit requirements, and we can promote healthy rather than perfect lawns. Slide 68. It is equally important to know what your program is not going to be, and we made it very clear that Show Me Yards is not going to be strictly an organic lawn care program. We had to be clear that it's not required under any laws because that was implied by a local attorney that we could make homeowners, quote, culprits, unquote, by their lawn care choices, so that was incorrect. And we are not in any way an opponent of commercial lawn care services. In fact, they were on our committee from the very beginning and a large part of our success. Slide 69, please. this is what it costs to get us started. When we started 3 years ago, we had a workshop. It cost us about $200 to launch our brochures. I will say that in 2007, we spent almost $2,000 because this has become one of our primary outlets for stormwater outreach and education. The city that I mentioned before that charged, for a similar workshop, they charged $45 for 3 evenings of sessions, and that was just to recover their own costs of copying and printing and room rental and things like that. So you can do this on a shoestring. It doesn't take a lot to get started. We just really have built ours up because it's been so effective. Slide 70. Some of the best features is our brochure is a very important first point of contact. It also includes a self-assessment scorecard, which I'm going to show a slide of. But most people don't really respond to printed matter. We in Outreach and Education love brochures, but the general public gets most of their information from TV, radio, and newspapers. So a brochure is an important take-home piece, but it's only one piece of an outreach puzzle, and maybe not even the most important one. So if we'll go to slide 71, our first attempt at starting this out started with 25 people for a 2-hour workshop, and at this point, we have to have 2 workshops a year. They're 8 hours long. You attend for 3 nights, and we have well over 100 people register for each one. We had a field day, which attracted about 250 visits, and I think it's important to tie into other things going on in your community. We have a Mayor's Bike Rock and Wheel Week here that is very well publicized, and thousands of people are involved with. So we tied our field day to that, and we promoted our event as bikeable and walkable. So you could come and look at Show Me Yards and the various aspects of them on your bike or make it a walking trip. Slide 72. This is the ad for one of our workshops. We tried to make sure we appealed to homeowners on the basis of what would interest them. Then while they're there, they also learn some new things they hadn't thought of, like the stream and lawn connection. So if the truth is told, the two things that will bring people to this kind of outreach are moles and crabgrass. Over and over again, people will come in Missouri to just solve those two problems. And they have lots and lots of questions about moles and crabgrass, and we can answer all of them. Slide 73, this was our scorecard. This is a self-assessment of a person's yard care choices. It's a nice interactive way for them to consider if there are alternative choices and decide for themselves if they want to change anything. So it's very thought-provoking. It's inside of every brochure. Everyone who attends a workshop rates their own yard first. It's also the basis of how we decided who would qualify to have a yard sign in their yard, which advertises Show Me Yards to your neighbors, and then they can talk about the choices and the changes that they made. So if you'll go to slide 74, as I said, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. We found this brochure. This Yahara Lakes is in Wisconsin. They were already doing a great event calling theirs Better Lawns and Gutters Tour. And slide 75, this is the inside of our tour. Our field day looks something like this. We have 2 permanently open sites with signage that you could visit anytime, but these were the 8 sites that you could walk or bike to. As I said, there are about 250 visits made on the day that we held this, and although you could theoretically bike to all of them, they were grouped so that you could really easily bike or walk to 4 on the east side of town and 4 on the west side of town, rather than try and see all of them, although there were people who came to all 8 sites, and it would take about 4 hours to do it. So slide 76, we were actually inspired by what they're doing in Seattle, Washington. I believe they've been having their equivalent of Show Me Yards or Florida Yards for about 10 years in the running, and I think this is probably still out there on their website. So if we'll go to slide 77, this is a close-up of the yard signs that we used as kind of a neighbor-to-neighbor approach. And slide 78 shows those signs up in someone's yard. So we use a regular little real estate box So if we go, let's see. We use a real estate sign so that your neighbors might stop by and or drive by and say, hey, are you selling your house? And then they learn something about Show Me Yards instead. Or if they don't want to ask you what you're doing, the brochures are right there, and anyone can walk by and pick up a brochure and learn something about watershed-friendly lawn care. Slide 79 shows four of the homes. We rotated these signs. I didn't, but our not-for-profit organization, which was called Show Me Clean Streams, they were actually in charge of all the signage, and they rotated these signs. See, when people filled out that self-assessment scorecard, the people with the highest scores were then contacted and asked if they would like to participate in this way, and I think 99% of the people we contacted said yes. And so you can see this would be really effective advertising. It gets us out all over the city. A lot of people think that if you reduce your pesticide or fertilizer use that you'll wind up with a sloppy-looking lawn, and you can see that just isn't the case. And you might note also that the home in the lower left-hand corner also has a rain barrel out front. So there are a lot of things that people were learning about on these site visits. Slide 80. This site, this was one of our permanently open sites. This is in a state park about 1 mile outside our city limits. It's a very popular park, so virtually everyone knows where this is, but they didn't know you could see a Show Me Yards demonstration site there. It's a permanent site with, this actually is an organic lawn, and a native plant garden. It's all native plants. And if you look at that little display up in the upper right photo, I'll show you a close-up of that, but we can just tell people at all our workshops that you can visit this site next time you're out at the park. And slide 81 is a picture of that display that was there in the yard. This is a permanent display, and it was paid for with grant funds from our Department of Natural Resources here in Missouri. Going to slide 82. This is an outgrowth of what we started with Show Me Yards 3 years ago. One of our Show Me Yards committee members attended a conference with this name, the Green Lawns Blue Waters, last fall, and he came back and told us about it. Then he actually volunteered to head up the effort. So rather than being homeowner-oriented, this was strictly for lawn care professionals. This person was actually part of the University of Missouri Extension. So we here at the city and the nonprofit deliberately stepped back and we relinquished control, encouraging them to build their own program, even down to choosing a different name. Now, we hope that Show Me Yards will go statewide, like Florida Yards and Neighborhoods. That is our dream, but it's not within our control. So that's why we went ahead and just launched this on our own. But we did just step back when they wanted to call it Green Lawns and Blue Waters. And the great news is that this workshop, which was just held this month, was highly successful. It also allowed for other great leadership and talent to emerge among our group. And we reached 60 lawn care professionals here on their first try. So that could easily account for about 1,000 acres of turf management in our area. This is what these guys do all day, every day. So this could be a big influence. Going to slide 83, I'm going to share with you a little bit about what we do in our Show Me Yards workshops and how we provide that first connection between streams and homes. So this will be the first few slides that we use in my workshop presentations. Next slide is slide 84. I back all the way up. I think it's important to me that people hear why the EPA, why the state of Missouri, and why our city is supporting Show Me Yards. This is an actual photo of the Cuyahoga River fire from 1969. It contains a quote from Time magazine that says, the Cuyahoga is chocolate brown, oily, bubbling with gases. It oozes rather than flows, and anyone who falls into the Cuyahoga does not drown, he decays. The lower Cuyahoga at that time had no visible life form, not even the low form such as leeches or sludge worms that usually thrive on waste. So this is a very low point for our nation's water system, but it also became the rallying cry for clean rivers and streams. So slide 85 explains the Clean Water Act, and that it's actually 35 years old, so it takes a while to turn things around. It took 3 years just to get the Clean Water Act passed after the Cuyahoga Fire, but it's important to, for people to know that it takes slow and steady progress, but it can be done, and I want our citizens to have the big picture of water quality, just not just lawn care connection. So it's also a source of inspiration of how far we have come already. Slide 86. Mr. Potts provided us with a great example of how watersheds work, and I always include this slide so people can understand how their home in Columbia, Missouri fits into the larger watersheds. And slide 87, every workshop that I hold has an actual map of the watersheds in our city with street names, and people can go see exactly which stream their storm drain in front of their house drains to. Slide 88. This beautiful little stream flows right through the heart of downtown Columbia, Missouri. It is a welcome refuge from city life. It's very heavily used. It's also a former EPA cleanup site, and I use this example to remind our citizens that urban streams can be a real asset to your community. If you note in the upper left-hand corner, there's a power plant right behind that big tree. This stream is one block away from our University of Missouri campus. Next slide, number 89. This is another well-known landmark. This is right behind our city-county building, and this is a good visual reminder that whatever goes down any storm drain, in this case it's going to be a cup, a plastic lid, and a can, will wind up floating in the stream we just saw in the previous slide. I want people to understand that this is not theoretical. This applies to the streets they drive, the storm drain next to their house, and the streams flowing through their city or county. So next slide. This is we're on slide 90. Again, this is a local photo taken on the main street through our city across from another famous landmark, and I think the little pellets here are probably lawn care products. I ask people to make a note of those cigarette butts, and that is a very short trip from here, going to slide 91, to here. Now, we can still see the cigarette butts loaded in the storm drain, but we can no longer see the nutrients or pesticides that came in with them. But they came in with those other things, and they're now dissolved in the water. So, slide 92. Last but not least, I use these actual photos as an example of indicators of a healthy stream. These fish are not dead. Citizens did not hear about a fish kill on the 6 o'clock news, but just like us, just like our own bodies, when we're stressed from either poor nutrition or inadequate housing or lack of sleep, we are more likely to get sick. Not die, we just get sick. And that's what we see in aquatic life when our streams contain urban stormwater pollutants, including those things from lawn care products. So I want to thank you for participating. You can contact me. Let's go to slide 93, and there's my information. You can contact me at mona.menezes@gocolumbiamo.com, and my area code's not on that slide, but it's area code 573-817-6447. And are there questions for me?
Okay, actually,
hello, actually, before we get to that, Mona, we will have time for some questions. However, let me first draw your attention to where you can obtain the contact information for all of our speakers today. If you are online, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speakers' email addresses and phone numbers. And next thing we will do is take an email comment and an email question, at least, for Mona. And the first comment comes from Greg from Ohio DNR, who is happy to report that the Cuyahoga River is doing much better now.
Thank you. I knew that.
Okay.
Good job.
All right. And we also have a question from Carl from Media, Pennsylvania, or Media, Pennsylvania, I'm not sure which. Have you heard of a program called Home Assist? Have you heard of specific applications of Home Assist? And for those who may not know, there's a lot of information on the web on Home Assist, and premier spot for and the originators of the program is with the University of Wisconsin Extension. And the website for that is www.uwex, for University of Wisconsin Extension, .edu/homeassist, and it's spelled HOMEASYST. And Mona, do you have any comment on that?
Yes, I do. Home Assist is excellent, and I believe this is an extension publication. And I think it's very important not to go on a sort of fear factor or a like e-news online, but it's important to me that I have my facts straight, that I know where the pollution's coming from, what the percentages are in my area, and yes, I use Home Assist because, you know, let Extension do the work. That's what they're good at, is pulling out those facts. And I try and stick to the facts and not get people all emotional of, oh, well, I think our water's polluted. Let's know exactly what we're dealing with here. And so Home Assist is very good with that.
Okay, at this time, if anyone would like to ask Mona a question over the phone, please unmute your individual line and give us your name and organization before your question.
It's so overwhelmed with email that good stuff gets mixed in with great.
Okay, I don't hear any actual questions. So at this point, we will now address any
remaining questions for Steve, Ondine, and Mona. And we're going to begin with a few submitted online. And Carl from Media, Pennsylvania, wants to know, do we have any information on the implementation of stormwater utilities on a way to manage impervious surfaces in a community? And I'll direct that to anybody.
This is Ondine here. I don't know of any specific examples where stormwater utilities have been doing this, but there might be cases, actually. So I don't have any specific answers to that.
Steve Potts, you might want to check with Florida.
This is Steve Potts. You might want to check with Florida. They have some pretty impressive nutrient best management practices for stormwater. And I can't remember the exact acronym, but they're using wetlands and all the ponds and basically growing algae in these stormwater catchment areas to take up nutrients. So I think we have your email address, and I'll get some more information and mail that to you.
Okay, and we have another question, and this one is actually for Ondine. And Greg from Ohio wants to know if there's any connection between Florida Yards and neighborhoods to the Clean Marinas program.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with the Clean Marinas program. We work in conjunction with a lot of local programs within the different counties. So, you know, for instance, in Sarasota, we are working with the estuary program there, and we, you know, we work with local programs in other counties. I'm not familiar with any specific collaboration with Clean Marinas.
Okay.
That sounds like something great to look into.
Okay, thank you for that. And I want to back up to some questions that were submitted right before the very first break to Steve that we did not have time to get to online. And this is from Mohsen in Jefferson City, Missouri. Some people talk about the importance of the ratio of total nitrogen to total phosphorus in water and how they could create a limiting factor. What do you think about this subject?
That's a great question. And in fact, we have a great webcast that addresses that on our OST website. The webcast is by Dr. Walter Dodds, who's one of the premier nutrient scientists in the country. And to access that webcast, you can go to www.epa.gov/water-science/criteria/nutrient. And once you reach that page, at the bottom of the left-hand side of the screen, you will see the word NSTEPS, which is the link to our technical support site, where you'll be able to find that webcast as well as some others. And also on that webpage, we're going to put some other information that would address a question from Sandra from Durham, North Carolina. She asked about atmospheric deposition, whether that contributed to the water body or the watershed. And in fact, it would be both, but we have a great piece we call the Nitrogen Backgrounder, which we're also going to put on that website. So be looking for that.
Okay, thank you, Steve. We did get another question for you. Robin from Salinas, California writes that here in California we're dealing with the growers' agreement with the growers of produce, I guess, that is destroying riparian habitats due to eradication of perceived pests causing health issues. How do we undo this damage to our downstream environments?
One of the concepts that we're trying to convey here is the formation of watershed groups and coalitions. So I would start with attempting to develop a coalition between your city, watershed groups that you may have locally, and your water board. And if the agricultural activities that you're referring to are in another water board's jurisdiction, work with that water board as well. We find that these coalitions tend to have a lot more success than people might think. And what I've observed in California is that there is a lot of interest in developing nutrient criteria. So I think you would find that the state as a whole has been making a lot of progress and would want to see nutrient criteria move forward. So that would be my recommendation.
Okay. At this point, I think we've exhausted the questions online, and I'm not going to try to risk any more attempts at getting some phone questions because we've had some technical difficulties. Please go ahead and move to slide 95 if you're not there already. Again, for those of you participating online, please take a look at the left-hand sidebar. You will see a links button which has additional resources identified for today's webcast. Also, finally, on the left-hand sidebar, you should see a feedback button. Please take a quick minute or two to go ahead and submit the online feedback form, as we really do value your comments as we strive to improve these webcasts. And this concludes today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of EPA's Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Steve Potts, Ron Dean Wells, and Mona Menezes for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who has joined us. This is Don Way from EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a gentle day, everyone.